Paul Simon, host. I was up for doing the very first show. It didn't seem like there was much downside risk. Then Lauren said, "No, let me just work out the kinks on the first show." But I would have been happy to do the first show. It would have been more historical. But he went with George Carlin, and I did the second one.
Edie Baskin. They had used publicity pictures of Carlin for the first show. I already had pictures of Paul Simon, so my pictures of Paul became the bumpers. And then Lauren said to me, "I think you should photograph next week's host instead of using publicity pictures." And that's how it all started. Penny Marshall, guest. I met Lauren when he came out and talked to Rob about hosting the third show. I wasn't anybody. I'd been on The Odd Couple, but Laverne and Shirley didn't go on until 4 months later. Rob was on All in the Family. I listened to Lauren talk to Rob at Lauren's apartment, and I kept my mouth shut. At the end, Lauren said to me, "Penny, what do you think?" And I said, "I think you're the most manipulative human being I've ever met, and you do it beautifully." And we've been friends ever since.
Neil Levy. Rob Reiner refused to go on after dress rehearsal. I was in his dressing room. It was hilarious because it was like a monologue, him going, "I can't do this show, I can't do this show. It's bad, it's horrible, I'm going to make mistakes, I don't know the lines. I can't do it, I'm not doing it, I'm sorry, that's it." And it was like he was not going to do it. And Lorne just talked him through it. And of course Rob did a good show. Albert Brooks. We had agreed on how I would make these movies, and certainly I wasn't going to make a living off of it. If I remember correctly, we agreed on a budget of like $1,000 a minute, which I bring up because it's funny that I was actually able to do that. I think all six films probably cost, you know, $50,000. Most of the films were 4 minutes, but one, the open-heart surgery movie, ran 13 minutes, and Lauren refused to air it. But then Rob Reiner, who is my close friend, hosted the show and insisted on showing it. Otherwise, it would never have been seen. Lorne Michaels. My agreement with Albert had been for films of 3 to 5 minutes. I'd wanted 3, he wanted 5. Because the heart surgery one was 13 minutes, it necessitated commercials in the middle and on either end, which meant we were away from the live show for close to 20 minutes.
Barbara Gallagher. Albert was always wanting more money. Lorne only needed like tiny pieces, and we were getting 10- and 12-minute pieces, and he'd be on the phone complaining, and I'd say, "Albert, we have a whole show here. You can't do those things. We don't have the time." He was good about it, but it was constant, constant. "You can't do this, Albert." Judith Belushi. In the first 3 shows, John was the opening scene of the first show, and I don't think he had a good scene again for 3 shows. Something that made a break of sorts was the 3rd or 4th bee scene, when he went off on "I hate being a bee," and this whole bee thing, and he had his antennae swinging around his head in some special way. It was really the first time he got to show his personality, and show that there was more to him, and he got a great response. But it took a while. It was slow to grow.
Chevy Chase. On Weekend Update, I was being a newscaster. I was being Roger Grimsby, actually. You know, it came out of that. "Good evening, I'm Roger Grimsby, and here now the news." One of the strangest pieces of syntax I've ever heard in my life. "And here now the news." But I knew I should say something, and on the 4th show it just came out. "Good evening, I'm Chevy Chase, and you're not." And that was it. Craig Kellum. There was a momentum from the beginning, but what was interesting was that, even though I don't remember the ratings being unbelievable after the first couple of shows, Lorne, ever the decider of what was what, decided the show was a hit right from the beginning and acted out of that belief, and it was infectious. I remember what he said. He said, quote, "I guess we're a hit." I thought, where's that coming from? But it was vintage Lorne Michaels. He believed it was a hit. He felt good about it. It got on the air. He looked on the bright side of the numbers and the bright side of the reviews. He certainly got good feedback from friends and family. And that was it. It was a hit show. It's wonderful the strength of his belief and how he sees things in this world.
Candace Bergen, host. After the first couple of shows, the dynamics of everything became so complicated and so loaded. People were learning things. They realized that you couldn't do the show stoned because they were missing their costume changes. A live show was not compatible with grass. And then the burnout rate was so high, especially for the writers, because they were really just putting in all-nighters routinely.
Dick Ebersol. Lorne and I never had any real disagreements between us until the fourth show, the first time Candace Bergen did the show. There was a complete fuck-up that night with NBC where they made this enormous electronic mistake. They basically cued real commercials off of fake commercials. Somebody wasn't paying attention in broadcast control, and Lorne went nuts. Lorne Michaels. Candy's show, the fourth show, was the first show, I would say, that was a Saturday Night Live like the ones we have now. The week before, when Rob Reiner hosted, Andy Kaufman did a long piece, there was a long Albert Brooks film, and a long monologue by Rob. On the Candy show, we sort of hit our stride. We'd had our first week off, and we worked hard on the writing. Dick Ebersol. Now comes week five. New York Magazine comes out with Chevy Chase on the cover. John is radically pissed off because he sees Chevy running away with the show. Now it's going to be all about Chevy. On stage, John had been the star, not Chevy. We do show six, which is a wonderful week. Lily Tomlin's come to do the show. Now we got Thanksgiving off. On Friday, we all get an advance copy of the Sunday New York Times. Major story, Saturday Night Live is called the most important and most exciting development in television comedy since Your Show of Shows. It's this drop-dead blowjob. It was just unbelievable. And this is the same New York Times that did not even review Show One with George Carlin. They also printed a review that John J. O'Connor wrote on the second show, where Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel got together again for the first time. And his review essentially was that the show was not very good, but he couldn't be entirely fair in saying that because he missed connections on his way home from dinner on the subway, and so he missed 40 minutes of the show. Can you believe that they fucking printed that thing? Lorne Michaels. It was humiliating that the critic thought it was a music show and reviewed it that way. He said, "Another Simon and Garfunkel reunion," of which there hadn't been one since 1968.
Margaret Obermann, writer. I remember being really disappointed when Lily Tomlin hosted, because we got so few women hosts, and growing up I always thought she was so funny and everything. So it was a little bit of an idolizing thing. And then when she came to the show, she was so condescending to us, especially to me and the other women writers. It was like, you know, you should really write about something you know about or something from real life. It was one of those kinds of things. It was like, oh my God. And she seemed completely oblivious to the fact that she was being so insulting. Rosie Schuster. One of the things we heard about the first four or five shows, while it was becoming the sensation that it would be, was that Chevy kind of jumped ahead of the pack, so to speak, and that started a kind of a resentment on the part of some people, particularly John, toward Chevy. Chevy was writing his own segment using his own name, "I'm Chevy Chase and You're Not," plus doing the physical shtick at the beginning. He was easily identifiable, whereas it took people so many years to catch on to what Danny's talent was, because he would disappear into characters. And Chevy just shot ahead. It wasn't that surprising. It was going to take John a little while longer. He was used to being beloved on the stage of the Lampoon show and had a following of people. But to translate to television, especially if you have an attitude about television, takes a little while.
Chevy Chase. I felt it was relatively easy. I'd come in and pick stuff up and learn stuff and simply walk through it, basically. I don't remember it being particularly difficult. You know, I have to say that going in, one of the things that made the show successful to begin with that first year, and made me feel successful, was this feeling of, I don't give a crap. And that came partially out of the belief that we were the top of the minors in late-night television, and that we wouldn't go anywhere anyway. So we had no set of aspirations in the sense that this would be a showcase to drive us to bigger and better things. Alan Zweibel. We worked on update to the very last minute. Between dress and air on Saturday nights, I would go up to my office, and I would watch the 11 o'clock news, and if something hit me, I'd write it, and it would be on television a half hour later. You know, there were two shows where I was literally under the update desk writing stuff and handing it up to Chevy while he was actually on the air. Robert Klein. Everyone was quite terrified about the live television aspect of the show. Most of the people in that building at NBC in New York hadn't done a live show since Howdy Doody. As a matter of fact, one of the first SNL shows had a blank gray screen for 45 seconds. A network show and nothing but gray for 45 seconds because of the improvising and screw-ups of doing it live. Neil Levy. Lorne quit on the Robert Klein show. They took away his lighting man and his sound man. Lorne had promised his guests the best sound and the best lighting. That was one of his promises to the people he'd gotten to do the first 10 shows. He was furious that NBC had taken away his people. I think he realized at the time that if he didn't make a stand, they'd be stepping all over him. So he told NBC that he would walk unless they returned his lighting guy and his sound guy. He left. He went back to his apartment and stayed there most of the week playing poker. Robert Klein showed up and said, "Where's the producer?" And we said, "Oh, he's around. He'll be here soon." And the whole week went by, and he wasn't there. But Lorne won. It was a victory. I think he came back Friday or Saturday. A lot of people would have said, "We'll make do with this sound guy and this lighting guy." And he said, "No, I've got to have the best." And that philosophy has served him well. Howard Shore. We were really kind of subversive in a number of ways. O'Donohue and I were always trying to book acts on the show and then do things to them. They were so happy to be on the show, they didn't really notice. I remember when Robert Klein hosted, O'Donohue put ABBA on a Titanic set and tried to drown them. He thought ABBA was kitsch. Lorne Michaels. ABBA was the first and only act that lip-synced, and that was Dick. Dick was ABBA. That was all he cared about. He left the rest of the music to me and Howard, but with ABBA, he just wouldn't take no for an answer. Dave Wilson. Lorne did not like lip-syncing, and Lorne did not like, and I always thought it was a tribute to him, Lorne did not like close-ups of fingers on instruments. He always said, "We're not giving music lessons." Because you want to see the man's or woman's face. It was their inner feelings in creating this music that was worth seeing, not where their fingers were placed on the strings.
Lily Tomlin. I don't remember entirely the first time I saw the show. I think I just thought it was a good young comedy show. What do you think I should have thought? I think Belushi always thought he was so cutting edge or so ahead in some ways, and he thought he was a rebel. Even though we liked him, we couldn't get him to come on our special. Jane had seen a lot of the Lampoon kids, and we tried to get some of them for our show. Live TV was old, basically, but this was like new because they were doing it in a different time frame. Jane Wagner and I had always wanted to do a live TV show because we had to spend all our money editing anyway. A live show is great. But you're always going to have rough spots, and there's always the chance of something happening. Having been on Laugh-In, and I guess just doing comedy for a long time, I thought it was hip, probably. Hip and current like that. I don't think I thought it was something I'd never seen before.
Chris Albrecht, agent, comedy club manager. I ran the improv in New York from 1975 to the very end of 79. Everybody came through there. Especially in the first year, several of the performers from Saturday Night Live would come into the improv on a semi-regular basis to go up on stage and try out characters and work out stuff. Belushi would come in a lot. Lorraine came in a few times. Gilda came in at least once. Belushi also came in to buy Quaaludes from his dealer every other week. On Saturday nights, we would always watch the show from the bar. At 11:30, we were just starting our second show at the improv. So it was funny people watching funny people. I was impressed that Saturday Night Live was on the air at all. Because we worked in a New York nightclub, all of us had this kind of snobby opinion that the New York comedy sensibility was the best that there was. The fact that this was a show in New York was always particularly pleasing to us. Howard Shore. By the time Lily Tomlin hosted, Lorne was sending the host over to the music department, which essentially was me in an office with a desk. NBC had a wonderful record library. Phenomenal. When NBC started, I believe they actually filed every recording ever released. I couldn't believe I had access to this library. I found this old blues recording of St. James Infirmary there and thought of doing an arrangement for the band. And I played that song for Lily, and she liked it. And O'Donohue said, "Have the band dress as nurses to do it." So we did. And I sang it with Lily. We did another show at Christmas where we all dressed as angels. It's just something that we got into. We've got these 10 guys and one girl, and what could we do with them that would be funny? Craig Kellum. Lorne had us working hard to induce Richard Pryor to host the show. Richard had a lot of questions and was playing very hard to get. We went to a Hi-Li arena in Miami where he was performing. That was the beginning of the Richard Pryor saga in terms of trying to get him to do the show. He wanted his ex-wife on the show, he wanted a couple of writers, performers on the show, and he wanted a tremendous number of tickets, which was an issue, really, because it wound up being the majority of the seats in the studio. So it was tough going. With Richard, as wonderful and as adorable as he was, it was also very tense being around him. Lorne loved Richard. He thought he was, quote-unquote, the funniest man on the planet. But it took so much work and effort to go through this process of booking him that Lorne, in a moment of extreme stress, sort of candidly looked around and said, "He better be funny." Once he was booked, Herb Sargent and I were assigned to go to his Park Avenue hotel and greet him and hold his hand. He was there in a suite with his guys, and the first thing he wanted to know was, where was the script? What we couldn't tell him was, there was no script. Everyone was just recovering from the last show, and there was the usual chaos. So we were in this uncomfortable situation. Now, Herb is a very gentle and sensitive guy, and in the course of this meeting, the pressure became so intense that Herb suddenly said he was going back to the office to get the script. He left the suite and never came back. And guess who was stuck there with 7 or 8 very angry guys? Richard knew there was a certain amount of bullshit going down. He was saying, "Where is that guy? What happened to him?" That was the beginning of the host game, which is, there is no script. Try to make them feel comfortable and, quote-unquote, trust me. Bernie Brillstein. When Richard Pryor hosted, NBC wanted a 5-second delay because they thought Pryor might say something filthy. We ended up with a 3-second delay, I think, but it was a new negotiation every week. Lorne Michaels. I resigned in pre-production over Richard Pryor in December. It was like an absolute, you can't have him from the network. And I said, I can't do a contemporary comedy show without Richard Pryor. And so I walked off. There was a lot of me walking off in those days. Richard did wind up hosting, of course, but he wouldn't come into the office until we started rehearsing, so I brought John over to his hotel to see him. John had done his Toshiro Mifune for his audition, and he did it for Richard, who thought it was funny. Richard wanted to do it on the show, and so we wrote Samurai Hotel.
Candace Bergen. I remember the terror. You know, the total exhilaration of it. I just didn't know you could have that much fun after 30. It was like the inmates taking over the asylum, totally. On the Christmas show, We did a skating routine, a sort of Sonia Henie B-capade skating routine. We went down to shoot the B-capades after Rockefeller Center had closed, after the rink had closed. So we were in the elevators at midnight, and I was dressed in a red velvet skating outfit with an ermine ruff, and then Belushi and Aykroyd and Chevy and somebody were dressed like bees. And the elevator operators, who still, after 2 months of the show, didn't know how to deal with it, never looked at any of us, never said a word. I think it was like that for a long time. You just couldn't understand how they took control of a place like NBC.
Lorne Michaels. The Candy Bergen Christmas show was not as good as the other candy show, so I went into a tailspin. Chevy and I and Michael went into the office and worked over the holidays, and that's when we wrote the Elliot Gould show, which later won the Emmy for writing that first season. We wrote a sketch where the Godfather goes to the shrink, and we were in a let's-just-blow-it-out state of mind. By that point, I'd hit stride. We all had, and everyone was focused. The Gould show was our first big show which wasn't about the host. Gould was just a big goofy guy who'd been in MASH. Elliot Gould, host. The first show I ever hosted was a very good show. One of the sketches was written by Michael O'Donohue. It was a psychogroup therapy session with Belushi as the Godfather in it. I heard it replayed on the radio recently, and it was so funny it even worked on radio. Lorraine Newman being in group therapy with Vito Corleone. I was the psychiatrist. My contribution was that I smoked a pipe. At this point, I don't think I would, but then I needed a prop. Also, I think it was the first show that I was the head of the Killer Bees, which was very, very funny. Through the show, there was a thread where Gilda Radner had a crush on me, and at the end of the first show that I did, we married. Gilda Radner and I had a wedding ceremony, and Madeline Kahn's mother was cast as Gilda's mother, and Michael O'Donohue married us at the end of the show. And that was the representative show they submitted, and it won them their first Emmy. I was really pleased to be a part of it. Buck Henry, host. On the first show I hosted, I made a suggestion for an ending for a sketch, because I came up in the school that says you end a sketch with an ending. And I heard one of the writers behind me say to the others, 1945. And I nodded inwardly. I see. I get it. It was considered really corny to go for a joke. They thought somehow it was like Carol Burnett. Lorne Michaels. Buck Henry came in to host and taught me a whole other level of things. Buck so totally got it. When he got there, he said, "Do you want to do the samurai again?" And we had never thought of repeating things until that moment. Alan Zweibel. I wrote all the samurais, with the exception of one. Belushi auditioned for the show with the samurai character. On the Richard Pryor show, Tom Schiller wrote a piece called Samurai Hotel, about a 2-minute piece or so, and that was that. That was like the 7th show we ever did. The 11th show we ever did, Buck Henry was hosting. Lorne came by my desk and said, "You used to work in a deli, didn't you?" I said, "You name it, I sliced it." Lorne said, "You would be perfect to write Samurai Delicatessen." I said, "Sure." I had no idea what he was talking about. But I wrote Samurai Deli and all the other samurais after that. What started as that 1 2-minute sketch ended up being a franchise. When I say I wrote all the samurais, what does that mean? It means I wrote all the stuff for Buck Henry or whoever did it that week, and then I go, "John throws up a tomato and slices it," and "John indicates in his gibberish whatever, you know." I wrote no dialogue for John. The only time I wrote anything that looked like dialogue for him was when I had to indicate what the gibberish was meant to convey. Buck Henry. On the samurai sketches that I did with John, one never knew where it was going because John's dialogue could not be written. You never knew what was going to happen next. In Samurai Stockbroker, he cut my head open with the sword, but it was really my fault. I leaned in at the wrong time, and I bled all over the set. It was a very amusing moment. You would not believe how much blood from a forehead was on that floor. A commercial came on right after the sketch, and someone shouted, "Is there a doctor around?" and John Belushi's doctor was in the audience, which made me a little suspicious. So the guy came and put this clamp on my forehead. We went on with the show. It didn't require stitches, darn it, but it required a clamp for the rest of the show. When Weekend Update came on, which was about 10 minutes later, Chevy appeared with a bandage on his face. Then Jane had her arm in a sling. They featured the moment when I got hit by the sword on Update like it was a hot news item. Only Saturday Night Live could do that. By the end of the show, when the camera pulls back, you see some of the crew are on crutches, others have bandages or their arms in slings, as if the whole show caught a virus. It was pretty funny. And the genius of Saturday Night Live, it seems to me, is encapsulated in that event. John didn't say anything to me right after it happened, but then we didn't see each other for another half hour at least. I was in one place and he was in another. But it wasn't John's forte to apologize anyway. Neil Levy. When Buck Henry got nicked by the samurai sword and everybody started wearing band-aids, they all bonded. I think it was the same show where Lorne had done that Beatles offer, and they got a phone call that John Lennon was over at Paul McCartney's house, and they were both coming over. Lorne was thinking, what are we going to do when they get here? He had an idea, he said. How about this? They get here, and they want to play a song, and I ask them where their guitars are, and they say they didn't bring their guitars, and I say, oh, well, then you can't play, because there's a union rule that you have to have your own guitar. His whole thing was to have the Beatles there and not let them play. I don't know if he would have gone through with it, but they never made it because they realized it was too late. Just the fact that they were on their way was good enough. Tom Hanks, host. I remember the first time I saw the show. I was working as a bellman in a hotel and got off late and came home. And one of the first things I saw was a parody of a razor blade commercial. Remember the one? It was in the first season, and it showed this cartoon of, here's how it works, the triple header, and they'd be yanking out this hair and doing this very painful thing. And I honestly couldn't figure out what I was looking at. Who would sell such a ridiculous product? And then I saw the first time they were in their bee costumes, and I could not figure out what was going on. I just thought, wow, okay, we're into the undiscovered country here if they're doing this kind of stuff on TV. Lorne Michaels. We wanted to redefine comedy the way the Beatles redefined what being a pop star was. That required not pandering, and it also required removing neediness, the need to please. It was like, we're only going to please those people who are like us. The presumption was there were a lot of people like us. And that turned out to be so. In its first weeks, the show looked little like it does today, different even from the episodes that aired mere months later. The repertory players got relatively little time at first, but that grew along with their popularity. Albert Brooks's films didn't turn out as Michaels had hoped, and there were frequent arguments over the fact that they weren't short enough. Brooks was angry, and is still irked to this day, that in its first review of the show, Newsweek gave credit for some of the clever parodies of network shows included in his short film, not to him, but to the show's writers and performers. In fact, Brooks was working in a virtual vacuum on the other side of the country. He went on to a brilliant career as comic and filmmaker. The Muppets didn't starve either. Soon after being dumped, they were signed by England's Lou Grade to star in The Muppet Show, a hugely profitable, globally syndicated half-hour that made Jim Henson a millionaire many times over. Alan Zweibel. Whoever drew the short straw that week had to write the Muppet sketch. The first time I met O'Donohue, I walked into Lorne's office, and Belushi's there, Aykroyd's there, people the likes of which had never crossed my path before. And I look in a corner of the room, and there's a guy I learned was Michael O'Donohue. What was he doing, you ask? He had taken Big Bird, a stuffed toy of Big Bird, and the cord from the Venetian blinds, and he wrapped the cord around Big Bird's neck. He was lynching Big Bird. And that's how we all felt about the Muppets. Franken and Davis and I were the rookie writers, and the others always rigged it so we were the ones who wrote the Muppet sketches. So I went over to Jim Henson's townhouse on, like, 68th Street with a sketch I had written. There was one character named Scred, and I remember we're reading the sketch, Jim Henson's reading the pages, and he gets to a line and he says, "Oh, Scred wouldn't say this." And I look, and on a table over there is this cloth thing that is folded over like laundry, and it's Scred. Oh, but he wouldn't say this. Oh, sorry. It's like when I was doing Gary Shandling's first series, we wanted to have Sherry Lewis and Lamb Chop on. I said, "Of course we'll fly you out," and she said, "Well, what about Lamb Chop?" "What about Lamb Chop?" She says that Lamb Chop gets a seat. I swear to God, I almost threw my back out, giving her the benefit of the doubt that she wasn't insane. I laughed, and she said, "Lamb Chop doesn't sit in the back." I said, "If I'm not mistaken, are we talking about the same Lamb Chop? Because, you know, it's a sock. It's a sock with a button, okay?" And it ended up we didn't use her, because it was too insane. Bernie Brillstein. O'Donohue had the best line about the Muppets. He used to say, "I won't write for felt." Craig Kellum. There was this shit or get off the pot moment when Lorne turned and looked at me, and he said, "How do you fire the Muppets?" Garrett Morris. A lot of people are very patronizing towards so-called handicapped people. They can take care of themselves. One thing about the kind of comedy we do is that it's a deeper realization of the fact that with all comedy, with all jokes, somebody's on the bottom. Albert Brooks. I think Lorne resented the fact that I was in Los Angeles. But the very reason that I set it up that way was so I could function and do what I knew I could do, and I didn't want to participate in the New York thing. And once the cast made it, then these little helper things, like my films, became, in Lorne's mind, less important, and the reasons for getting me were pretty much over. Because what function did I provide for him? I made him something that got him great attention and great reviews, and more importantly, I did the publicity for them. After those six films, that was it, because I don't think Lorne Michaels would ever again do anything outside of New York. I think that really was something that he never wanted. He didn't like not having control over all of the product. Dan Aykroyd. At first I stayed at Belushi's house, living with him and his wife, sleeping at the foot of their bed, having their cats attack me. I lived there for 2 months. Finally, I said, "I gotta get out of here." John loved having me there, and Judy was very sweet, but I met a guy who worked in the graphics department at NBC, and we had a loft downtown for a while. Had some great parties there.
Judith Belushi. John and Danny had met much earlier, and they liked each other instantly. Danny had come in at one point and stayed at our house for a couple of nights. I know he says he slept at the foot of the bed. It wasn't literally the foot of the bed. Actually, it was another room. He remembers it that way, though. It seemed like the foot of the bed to him.
Howard Shore. Dan had bunk beds because we had no money. We were paid so relatively little money, really, by NBC. I think they were paying me $500 per show, not per week. I think the first year I made $10,000 when we actually created the show, so we had no real lives. Paul Schaefer. We were young and nobody had much else to do. We used to be there all night writing. Lorne was a night owl, and he encouraged this. Those were the kind of hours he wanted to keep. So that was his schedule. That Monday night would be the first meeting pitching ideas. Tuesday, he'd start after dinner and just stay up until you had some stuff written, and then you'd drag yourself out of bed Wednesday and come in for the first read-through of the material, which used to start, theoretically, at 1. Not only was it weird hours, but it was long hours. People were really devoted to the show. There was not necessarily much social life. Our whole life was the show. Lorne Michaels. The thing I was worried about most in those days was the dry cleaners and getting my clothes back. I probably only owned 2 or 3 pairs of jeans and 4 or 5 shirts, so you could get in a jam where there were no clean clothes. I lived above a chock full of nuts at 57th and 7th, so I could always go down in the morning and have a coffee and a whole wheat sugar donut. When Buck Henry came to the show, he carried the New York Times around with him the whole day, and he would read it, A1, A2, A3, all in sequence. He didn't consider himself done until he'd read the whole paper. And I went, wow. I certainly didn't think of myself as unsophisticated, but you could make up a whole world out of what I didn't know back then. But there was no time for anything but the show. Around the offices, I think early on I realized that if I looked like Henny Penny, then pretty much that would be infectious. So when I was really frightened, when I was young, 30 when I began, I would hold a glass of wine and people would go, well, he seems pretty cool and relaxed. Buck Henry. One problem was, Lorne couldn't fire anybody. He was constitutionally unable to do it, at least early on. Once hired, it was sinecure. I think Lorne felt it was an admission of failure if you have to fire somebody you've hired. Alan Zweibel. You know, Lorne did a thing which was really, really, really brilliant. And I don't know how long it lasted, it might have just been the first year. He wanted the public to know the cast as people beyond the roles that they played. So he would have a cast member just say, "Hi, I'm Dan Aykroyd, da-da-da-da-da." Just a little personality thing. With Gilda, she would sit on the edge of the stage, and she only did it twice, maybe, and it was called What Gilda Ate, and she would tell what she ate during the week. There weren't jokes in it, it was mostly personality things.
Rosie Schuster. Beats and I were sort of thrown together to write, and we were the first two females there. Marilyn Suzanne Miller wasn't there at the very, very beginning. We sort of circled each other suspiciously for a short amount of time. I was always romantic about the idea of feminism, but the first time she saw me, she exclaimed really loud, "Jesus, look at those tits!" So it got a laugh in the room, and that was sort of unsettling, you know? But we were thrown together, and then we definitely bonded, because there was a lot of testosterone around there. There was a lot of energy, and it was combustible, and it was exciting. It was hard to be female, it always was, you know? Gilda had a good coping device for that somehow, because she could just be charming and darling. When you're actually pushing your own material, when you're in the trenches with the guys, it's a little harder. We were in the front lines, like Vietnam nurses. It was intense. It was very, very intense.
Lorne Michaels. In the beginning, there were two things John didn't do. He wouldn't do drag, because it didn't fit his description of what he should be doing. And he didn't do pieces that Anne or Rosie wrote. So somebody would have to say that a guy had written it. Yet he was very attached to Gilda and to Lorraine. Dan Aykroyd. There was a correspondence dinner that we went to in Washington. John and I played Secret Service agents to Chevy's Gerald Ford. Chevy invited us to come. It was at his behest. He was supposed to do Ford, and he said, "I want to bring John and Dan down with me." That John even went on that trip was interesting, because he had his problems with Chevy. Just who's the bigger star, who's doing more important work, that type of thing. Of course, they had a history because they'd worked in the Lampoon show together. So I think there was time for issues to foment there. Lorne Michaels. That was a magical day in Washington. But we couldn't get over the fact that Belushi went to the White House without an ID. We get to the White House, the car's pulling up, we give our names at the gate, and they ask for ID, and John says, "I didn't bring any." All of us. "John, how can you not? How can you not bring ID?" But we vouched for him, and they let us through.
Judith Belushi. He had no ID with him when we got married. We eloped and went to get married in Aspen on New Year's Eve, and he has no ID. And when he's asked for any kind of identification, it's like he doesn't have any. And John says, "Have you ever seen a show called Saturday Night Live?" And the woman says, No. Then he pulls out this review of the show that he carried around and says, "See here, this is me, John Belushi." And she's looking at him like, "You must be crazy." And I said, "You're telling me no one has ever gotten married without an ID? No one? Ever? There must be someone who lost all their stuff. What did they do?" She said, "Oh, well, if he had a letter from a judge." We said, "Okay," and went to the phone and called a judge. And John said into the phone, "Hello, Judge. I'm sorry to bother you at home, but have you ever heard of a show called Saturday Night Live?" And the judge says, "Yes." And John says, "Oh, good. I have this problem. I'm here with my girlfriend, and we're trying to get married." And the judge came down, and he did an affidavit and okayed it. John showed up everywhere with no ID. He had trouble holding on to his wallet.
Al Franken. I went up to New Hampshire with my brother, who was a press photographer, to follow the campaign in 76. And I ran into Ron Nessen, who was the White House press secretary. I told him I was the writer of this show, and I was surprised that he had seen it and that he liked it. I said, "Well, you should be on the show." And I went back to the office a few days later and I told Lorne. He kind of had to remind me that he was the producer of the show and that I had only been in show business for about 10 minutes. I was a writer. But anyway, Nessen ended up coming on.